Chapter 34. He kept us out of war. The withdrawal of German submarines proved counterproductive for the Allies. The fewer ships that were sunk, the less America was likely to weigh in for the British. American ships had to be sunk and American indignation had to be raised. For this purpose, the British needed the German submarines back in action. House was designated for this mission of provocation. On November 17, 1916, a few days after the elections, he would write, "If we have to go to war, let it be against Germany." Yet a number of events were still to thwart the British lobby in America. The mail scandal particularly angered Wilson. The British had gotten into the habit of seizing American mail on United States ships they searched. British inspectors had control of all American correspondence for whatever purpose they chose. House quotes Wilson, "The way this thing is going, I think solid retaliation is the only way to deter them." House, 2, 354. The China incident was the last straw. The British boarded the U.S. ship China by force, seized the mail and began to interrogate the American passengers, who were then taken off the ship as prisoners. It was piracy at its worst. House was embarrassed and had to write to his British friends, "I cannot conceive that the British could have taken 50 people off the American vessel China." Sir Edward Grey harshly dismissed House's lament. House wrote, "Sir Edward could hardly invent anything that would more surely cool the ardently pro-British sentiments of Americans such as myself." House, 2, 341. Seymour wrote, "Mr. Wilson was extremely troubled by the Allies' attitude, particularly when Germany, which had submitted to the President on the submarine dispute, was not giving him any problems at the moment." House did not hide his apprehension, "It is starting to get on the President's nerves. From now on his suspicions of Allied motivations will only deepen." House, 2, 339. The British practice of blacklisting also angered American opinion. On July 18, 1916, the government of the United Kingdom published a list of more than 80 American corporations with which it was forbidden to trade because they had commercial relations with an enemy of the Allies. The number of blacklisted companies has now risen to 1,500. House, 2, 348. Thus, 1,500 American companies were cut off from credit, supplies, and trade. One wonders what would have happened if Germany had committed the tenth of such an action. Professor Seymour explains the boycott. British shipping companies were advised not to accept freight from the proscribed firms. Companies of neutral countries were given to understand that if they took freight from the blacklisted American firms, they too would run the risk of seeing their freight rejected in British ports. Bankers of such countries would no longer finance blacklisted traders. On July 22, 1916, advisor Polk wrote to House, "The blacklist just published by the British government is creating considerable irritation. Something will have to be done." The next day Wilson lost patience and House was asked to recall Ambassador Page from London. House was grasping for excuses. "They are perhaps imprudent in their methods, blinded by their interests or their immediate needs," adding, "the Allied attitude results for the most part in that they do not realize they have a kind of instinctive feeling for considering the high seas as inalienable British property." Thus the British-American conflict worsened from week to week. American public opinion demanded countermeasures. Congress had also lost patience. In September 1916, President Wilson was given special powers authorizing him to take, if necessary, violent means of reprisal. British Ambassador Cecil haughtily replied, "If you attempt to put these measures into effect, it would result no doubt in the breaking of diplomatic relations and the end of all trade between the two countries." House, 2, 357. The State Department reported, "Our relations with Great Britain are worsening," while Wilson complained privately that "the Allies are exasperating beyond description." People wondered whether the threat of an American intervention would be diverted from Germany and against the United Kingdom. By the end of 1916, this threat became quite real. The United States government was prompted to act. A decision was taken that would change the British role forever. The United States would no longer tolerate British rule over the seas of the world, British dictatorship over neutral countries, British seizure of mail, kidnapping of American passengers, and blacklisting of American companies. The United States took the historic step of building 137 new ships. Shortly, the British Navy was facing an American fleet of equal might, which would soon grow mightier. Britannia's pretension to rule the waves had decreed that Germany would be prohibited from expanding its maritime trade. Britain had started a war to prevent such a possibility. The British claim of dominion over the seas was now being challenged and swept away by Britain's keenest trading partner. The British monopoly might be broken at last. Other countries, including Japan, would eventually outstrip the British. Wilson was as determined as Congress. Let us build a stronger navy than theirs and let us act as we see fit. House, 2, 353. The British had practiced too much perfidy and hypocrisy for their own good, they had shot themselves in the foot. In 1916, Congress struck a fatal blow at arrogant British imperialism. American public opinion against the British was also reinforced by the testimony of millions of Irish Americans who had fled the ruthless colonization of their native land by Britain. Their forebears had been slaughtered and persecuted for centuries by the British, and more recently they had vividly felt the bloody massacre of Irish patriots during Easter, 1916. The British had put down the quest of Irish independence with more savagery, and it had massacred Zulus in Africa. The inhuman treatment traditionally reserved for Irish prisoners in British jails triggered widespread indignation in the United States. American sympathy went without question to the Irish prisoners, who were very harshly treated. This was objectively reflected in a Senate resolution. House, 2, 353. Sir Edward Grey sent House on August 28, 1916 a stern reprimand. The attitude of the Senate, voting for a motion in favor of Irish soldiers without worrying about atrocities committed in Belgium, caused us a painful impression. House abjectly disowned the United States motion and even apologized to the British. It surpasses the record of blind acts committed by my unfortunate country. The British reference to Belgium particularly angered Americans. State Secretary Lansing replied at once, "The hypocritical language of the British as far as Belgium is concerned fills us with indignation." House, 2, 355. Even the pro-British Page conceded, "The British would have fought alongside the French even if the French government had violated Belgium's neutrality to reach German soil more efficiently." The question now was whether the United States would cut off aid to the Allies. 1916 was a very bad year for the Allies. The British were losing everywhere. Even the vaunted Royal Navy lost a major sea battle off Jutland, on May 31, 1916, despite the fact it outnumbered the German force 2-1. Their losses were double those of Germany, despite the fact that a British spy ring had informed their Admiralty of German Admiral von Scheer's plans for breaking the blockade. Von Scheer had no wish to fight it out with the bulk of the Royal Navy and had planned to lure a number of British cruisers close to Norwegian coast. Since his plans had become known, he had to face the entire Royal Navy. The clash was hard fought and Germany lost 6 ships and 2,551 sailors, the British lost 12 ships and 6,094 sailors. British pride was hurt by facing a better naval force, with better crews, better commanders and more accurate firepower. The British, galled by their defeat, switched their attention to the propaganda front with rancorous vengeance. The British claimed that a German submarine, the U-53, had torpedoed 6 Allied vessels near the American coastline. An official inquiry confirmed the U-53 had sunk 6 vessels, but well outside United States territorial waters. Professor Seymour also agreed, the U-53 actions were strictly within the norms of maritime war usage. The British hardly conformed to this usage. German Ambassador Bernstorff pointed out that British submarines sank German freighters without warning and without regard for human lives every day of the week. Once more, an anti-German campaign in the United States had failed miserably. Despite famine and provocation, the Germans stuck to their policy of not giving House an excuse to push America into the war. The price was heavy. The blockade was starving civilians while the British were shipping millions of tons of arms without fear of German attack. Kaiser Wilhelm had ordered the policy because he believed his moderation would lead to peace. The German policy of moderation lasted throughout 1916, British propaganda notwithstanding, as indicated by State Department reports. German submarine warfare was conducted according to maritime law. This report appears in the House private papers. The Kaiser's policy, however, was being increasingly criticized in Germany. The principal argument put forward against the Chancellor was that he gave in to the United States, although he knew very well the American government did not act as a neutral. It put pressure only on Germany while allowing Britain to break international law. Germany Ambassador Bernstorff officially warned President Wilson as early as October 18, 1916 that Germany could no longer sacrifice its national interest. The German government foresees the time when it will be forced to take back its freedom of action. House, 2, 374. Wilson was full of misgivings. If we send Bernstorff back and go to war, we will be covered with flowers for a few weeks, then calls will be made on our money. The money we give will not last long, and then there will be demands for an unlimited number of soldiers. Admitting that we subscribe to all their, the Allies, demands. Wilson's comments were quite prophetic. A few months later, he would see his worst fears realized. House was very concerned over Wilson's frame of mind at the time. Congress demanded sanctions against the British government. House could clearly see the day where both Wilson and Congress would decide to stop the flow of goods and money to the Allies. As the November election grew near, House was faced with a 90% non-interventionist electorate. Even when his infatuation with British pomp and his allegiance to the British establishment impelled him to promote war, he was forced by political realities to appear pro-American. Likewise, Wilson had to set aside his secret hatred of the Germans, as well as House's machinations, if he wanted to win the election. He presented himself as the peace candidate who would defend American neutrality at any cost. Yet his peace promises did not sway the electorate, which wanted more tangible proof. It became a matter of hiding any pro-Allied leanings and convincing the voters that the administration was more than 100% for peace and neutrality. Wilson never tired of referring to the Allies' war as a complex mystery. The origin of this peculiar war or its objectives have never been revealed. History will have to search a long time to explain this conflict. Bullet, President Wilson, 280. Such statements made it difficult for the American voters to imagine that their author would throw them into a foreign war, one he himself admitted he could not understand. In July 1916, Wilson received the Democratic nomination for president. His campaign slogan was built around the theme, "He had kept us out of war, he has maintained our neutrality." As Bullitt pointed out, however, Wilson, knowing he had been trying for the last 8 months to drag Americans into the war, had such a bad conscience about it that he avoided during all his campaign speeches any mention of having maintained neutrality in the past. This notion was left to others, such as Governor Glynn of New York, to propagate. Thousands of posters and leaflets were distributed in every American town, particularly in the West, where anti-war sentiment ran stronger. "He has maintained America's neutrality," became the Democratic Party slogan. The massive propaganda blitz made Wilson synonymous with peace and neutrality. Bullitt added, "If the American people had known he was trying to get them into war, he would have experienced a crushing defeat." Wilson remained aloof throughout the campaign. "The president has left everything in our hands. He has not phoned, made the slightest suggestion, or given any advice," said House. House was thus empowered to run a pro-neutralist campaign as he saw fit. He was determined to sabotage this policy as soon as the elections were over. He would find a way to drive the Germans into some act of desperation, which he hoped would reverse neutrality. House had by then become a master of ruse and subterfuge and felt quite confident his talents could be used to influence events. One can always rely on the Germans to commit some psychological mistakes at the critical moment. For House, the campaign was just another necessary duplicity. The American people were being duped on a massive scale. House in his role as standard-bearer of neutrality would say or promise anything to secure Wilson's re-election, which in fact would guarantee his own tenure in the seat of power. With another term up his sleeve, everything would be possible for House. Thus, on November 7, 1916, Wilson was re-elected President of the United States. But the results showed that House had not fooled all the people. Wilson was elected by a small margin. For a while it looked as if he had lost. The New York Times even announced his Republican opponent the victor. Later, a victory celebration was organized for Wilson, but it was more like a funeral. House declined to attend because he did not want to be associated with defeat. Lansing and McCormick went and they told me they had never been to such a mournful event. House, 2, 282. Finally, after 4 days of hope and despair, Wilson emerged as the winner by a head. He owed his election to the ambiguous votes of the Western states, all in crushing majority against the war, House, 2, 282. Wilson's inaugural speech still reflected his campaign promises, "I formally declare that the time has come for the United States to play an active role in establishing peace in the world and ensuring its continuance. I solemnly undertake to keep my country out of war." House, 2, 422, 428. Wilson appeared to be genuinely impressed by the strength of anti-interventionist sentiment in America. Back in the White House, he clearly, for a few weeks at least, respected the popular will. When House tried to broach the subject of America's participation in the war for the first time, Wilson stood up to his alter ego. Sigmund Freud and Bullitt called it Wilson's last stand. When on January 4, 1917 House pressured him to prepare for war, Wilson replied, "There will be no war, the country has no intention whatsoever to let itself be dragged into this conflict. We are the only neutrals among the great peoples of the white race, and to cease being neutral would be a crime against civilization." House, 2, 288. For months later House and the Allies would be swamping Wilson and the crime against civilization would start to take shape.